yards wide. Pieces of the bombs and the plane were scattered across an area of 3 square miles. The pieces were small and highly radioactive. Tiny particles of plutonium had bonded with metal and plastic debris, mixed with jet fuel, water, and ice. Plutonium had risen in the smoke from the fire and traveled through the air for miles. The one-point safety tests of the Mark 28's core, performed secretly at Los Alamos during the Eisenhower administration, had been money well spent. If the Mark 28 hadn't been made inherently one-point safe, the bombs that hit the ice could have produced a nuclear yield. And the partial detonation of a nuclear weapon, or two, or three, without any warning, at the airbase considered essential for the defense of the United States, could have been misinterpreted at SAC headquarters. Nobody expected the Thule monitor to destroy Thule. Instead, the Air Force had to confront a less dangerous yet challenging problem: how to decontaminate about 3 square miles of ice, about 700 miles north of the Arctic Circle, during the middle of winter, in the dark. Generators, floodlights, a helicopter pad, sleds, tracked vehicles, and half a dozen prefabricated buildings were brought to the crash site. New roads from the base were cut through the snow. A hotline was drawn around the contaminated area, with restrictions on who could enter it and decontamination control points for everyone who left it. Once again, hundreds of young airmen walked shoulder to shoulder, looking for bomb parts and pieces of a B-52. Most of the debris was small, ranging from the size of a dime to that of a cigarette pack. Some of it had fallen through a gash in the ice, cut by the crash, that later refroze. The ice was about 2 feet thick, the water below it 600 feet deep. Pieces of the bomb and the plane were carried away by the current or settled on the bottom of Bylot Sound. Arctic storms with high winds complicated the recovery and cleanup efforts, spreading plutonium dust and hiding it beneath the snow. But the levels of contamination were more accurately measured at Thule than at Palomares. A new device, the Field Instrument for the Detection of Low-Energy Radiation, Fiddler, looked for the X-rays and gamma rays emitted by plutonium instead of the alpha particles. Those rays traveled a longer distance and passed through snow. Over the next 8 months, the top 2 inches of the blackened ice within the hotline were removed, trucked to the base, condensed, packed in containers, shipped to Charleston, South Carolina, and then transported by rail to the AEC facility in Aiken. The radioactive waste from Thule filled 147 freight cars. During the summer of 1968, after Bylot Sound thawed, a Navy submersible searched for part of a Mark 28 bomb. The plutonium cores of the primaries in all 4 weapons had been blown to bits, and most of the uranium from their secondaries had been recovered. But a crucial piece of one bomb was still missing, most likely the enriched uranium spark plug necessary for a thermonuclear blast. It was never found, and the search later inspired erroneous claims that an entire hydrogen bomb had been lost beneath the ice. The Air Force did a much better job of handling the press coverage at Thule than at Palomares. It helped that the B-52 had crashed near one of the most remote military installations in the world, far from any cities, towns, or tourists. An accident that contaminated 3 square miles of a large metropolitan area would have gained more attention. The Air Force admitted from the outset that nuclear weapons had been involved in the crash. Dozens of journalists were flown to Thule within days of the accident and supplied with a good deal of information. Few had the desire to remain in the Arctic for long, and a couple of other news stories, the seizure of the USS Pueblo by North Korea and the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, quickly pushed Thule off the front page. The Air Force account of the accident, however, was deliberately misleading. Denmark had imposed a strict ban on nuclear weapons, and its NATO allies were forbidden to bring them into Danish territory or airspace. For more than a decade, The Strategic Air Command had routinely violated that prohibition at Thule. The B-52 that crashed onto the ice, the Pentagon told reporters, had been on a training flight and had radioed that it was preparing to make an emergency landing. A handful of people within the Danish government and its military were no doubt aware that B-52s had been flying nuclear weapons over Danish territory every day for almost 7 years. But they may not have known that atomic bombs were stored in secret underground bunkers at Thule as early as 1955. Hydrogen bombs were deployed there the following year. Before the introduction of SAC's airborne alert, Thule was a convenient spot for bombers to land, refuel, and pick up their weapons en route to the Soviet Union. The early hydrogen bombs were so heavy that pre-positioning them in Greenland would allow SAC's planes to make the long round-trip flight to Russia over the North Pole. Dozens of anti-aircraft missiles with atomic warheads were later placed at Thule to defend the base from a Soviet attack. But none of these facts were shared with the Danish people. The airborne alert program was terminated the day after the Thule accident. The risks no longer seemed justifiable, and many B-52s were now being used to bomb Vietnam. SAC's ground alert was unaffected by the new policy. Hundreds of planes loaded with hydrogen bombs still sat beside runways all over the United States, ready to take off within minutes. And a B-52 secretly continued to fly back and forth above Thule day and night without nuclear weapons, just to make sure it was still there.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.